I am Plant Online. This is the commentary.ca. Jay Ingram is one of Canada's best-known science popularizers in the media, radio, print, internet, and television. He's a co-host and producer of Daily Planet, television's first daily science show. He joins me this day to discuss his latest book, The Daily Planet Book of Cool Ideas, Global Warming and What People Are Doing About It, published by Penguin. The book gives an overview of global warming and what we can all do for dealing with a planet that's heating up. In Vancouver this day, please welcome to the Plant Online program, Jay Ingram. Good morning, Mr. Ingram.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. Yourself?
Good, thank you.
Did you do a lot of traveling for the research of this book?
Actually, I didn't, because the way we put the show together, because we're, you know, we really try and cover international science, and we have, 15 or 16 producers on staff, and because it's a daily show, I have to be in Toronto to host it. So whatever traveling was done was actually done pretty much mostly by the producers of the program. And in fact, you know, if you're going to do a book on global warming, the less traveling you do, the more responsible you are, because travel, especially air travel, is one of those things that exacerbates the problem.
There are a lot of books on this subject as of late. What's different about this book than all the others?
I think that there are a couple of things. One is because it was based on a week-long series we did on Daily Planet about a year and a half ago, it's really a visual book. I mean, there are illustrations. There's not one page that doesn't have an illustration of some kind on it. Most of them, or the majority of them anyway, taken from the original TV series. So, you know, it's really eclectic and fully illustrated that way. The other thing is, you know, television, for us anyway, seems to work best when we have really curious and interesting people. And it doesn't matter whether they're, you know, scientists with PhDs or engineers or whether they're backyard inventors. As long as they've come up with something interesting, we like to talk to them. So this book has a lot of people that you wouldn't find in any other book about global warming, ranging from, you know, teenage kids who turned their pickup truck into an electric hybrid, or actually a plug-in electric, to, 80-year-old grannies who cook their chicken dinners in a solar oven. So the important thing is not so much, it is not actually that they're experts necessarily, but that each one of them in the book has an idea or a point of view that we thought was important to hear. And so, you know, it's more like a festival of ideas, and we're not saying that, you know, you, the reader, should do all these things. Of course not, because some of them are just a little bit too wild and crazy for everybody to do. But it's important to see that there are people out there having ideas and doing something.
So somebody that you feature in the book, Fergus the Forager, I guess
yeah.
His name says it all. Where is he from?
He lives in the UK, and he, as you say, forages for his food. And the surprising thing about him is that it's amazing what you can find on the landscape that you can eat, as long as you're sort of knowledgeable about what you do. So he actually wanders around in the UK, and you know it's. There aren't as many wild spots in the UK as there are here, certainly. And, you know, pulls up plants that most people would simply ignore, and knows how to prepare them, knows how to cook them, knows what's safe to eat and what will make you sick. He has, in his life, eaten a lot of roadkill, although I don't think it's a major part of his diet. But, you know, and he does say if you're going to eat roadkill, you've got to get to it pretty quickly after the event. It's all part of the food that's out there, and he'll fish using, you know, really primitive stuff, and then cook a fish buried in the sand on a beach and add some beach plants and actually have quite a nice dinner. So he actually set out after we did our series, he was going to try and go for an entire year without buying any food. And I don't know, the last time I checked his website, he hadn't put in an entry for a while, so I don't really know how that's going. But I think he shows that you could actually do that if you really wanted to. Now, you know, do you really want to? That's the question. But at least it shows you that we can get food in a different way than we're used to getting it, and doesn't have to be plastic wrapped and shipped from Venezuela or New Zealand or something like that.
Throughout history, as you open the book, you say that the Earth has cooled and warmed. throughout. Could it cool again? And what's the difference now?
Well, the difference now, despite what some climate change deniers would have you believe, is that the rate of warming is different now than it ever has been in the past. And that's been really well ascertained. There's a famous graph called the hockey stick graph, which has been criticized a lot, and there were some statistical flaws in the first version of it, but it's been updated since, and it basically looks like a horizontal hockey stick laid on the ground, where you have global temperatures going along like the shaft of the stick, not going up much or up or down at any time, and then there's a sudden uptick in the 20th century that corresponds to the blade of the hockey stick, and it really does show that, yes, there's been ups and downs, and there have been cold periods, and there have been warm periods, but the rate of warming right now is greater than it ever has been. And what else is happening now? Well, the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is going up at a rapid rate as well. And theory says that if you increase the carbon dioxide, you're going to increase the temperature. So, you know, it's all pretty much straightforward. You'll hear a lot of people suggesting these days, well, you know, actually global temperatures haven't increased much in the last 4 or 5 years, that they've been pretty stable. And even at least the National Post printed a graph suggesting that global temperatures were going down. But, you know, you can't base it on what's happened last year or this summer or even the last couple of years. You've got to watch the long-term rise of temperature is what you're interested in, not the short-term ups and downs. It's like the stock market. It's actually going in the opposite direction than the stock market. So, you know, I have no doubt that global temperatures are rising. I was just reading a minute ago or so about a glacier that's really high up in the Himalayas, something like 6 kilometers up. And it hasn't actually grown in the last 50 or 55 years. So that gives you some idea of how warm the world has been getting.
And some people think, Gwyn Dyer was on a couple weeks ago, and he thinks that we're doomed. He says that unless dramatic change happens now and happens quickly, we're not going to survive this. Do you believe that? I mean, do you think there's room for us to either adjust, or do we need to make wholesale change quickly?
Well, you know, he's not even the most gloom and doom of the bunch either. There's a guy named James Lovelock in England who would say essentially what Dyer says, that we're doomed. But he wouldn't even say unless we do this, this, or that. He thinks we're doomed no matter what we do. And, you know, he would say that any sort of personal changes people make in terms of their, you know, driving habits or flying less and anything like that is just trivial, and had it been done in the 1960s, it might have made a difference, but it won't now. But, you know, it's very hard for, people can say that we're doomed, but I'm not really sure what the point of that is. I mean, does that mean we should just abandon any efforts to control our carbon dioxide emissions? That doesn't make much sense to me. I think what's going to happen is there will be serious changes. And the question is, unless we start acting on it now, and, you know, I don't think we have, like, you know, people say, well, we've got 5 years, we've got 10 years. I don't think we can pay much attention to that. I think we just have to start acting as fast as humanly possible. And then, you know, there's a lot of sort of backlog stored in the system because the oceans have been absorbing a lot of carbon dioxide. And, you know, we've got enough carbon dioxide absorbed in the ocean that's going to, as it's released, will continue to raise global temperatures in the future. So even if we start acting now, we're not going to see any substantial benefit for maybe 20 years or more. And, you know, governments like our own are saying, well, we'll reduce carbon dioxide emissions by 2020 or something like that. That's really too slow. But I think that we have to act quickly, and then there will be changes, bad changes, but, you know, as long as we're acting and we can look beyond those to a time when things will be better, I think that's the best we can do. I don't see the point of giving up or just saying, well, you know, we've had it. I think, though, that people will have to realize that it's going to be a different world in 30 years than it is now. And, you know, my generation is going to be blamed for it, and probably rightly.
So some say that changing our lives, you know, other than the trivial things like driving less, or even those trivial things like driving less or changing your light bulbs, is difficult, that it's costly. Is that your sense? And I guess from this book, it's not.
Well, yeah, I mean, what, you know, it really doesn't take an awful lot of effort to change a few light bulbs or drive less. And if people are going to... if people are going to say, I can't even manage that, then we really are doomed. Because, and, you know, people cling to the opposite argument that really nothing, the world is cooling, it's not warming. I mean, that stuff's garbage. But people who don't want to change will cling to that. And because who wants to, you know, if you're living a good life, who wants to make radical changes in it? Fortunately, you know, there are political leaders. We'll see what happens in this country, but at least Barack Obama is on, you know, on the case, and he will make changes there where no changes, except bad ones, were made in the Bush administration. And, you know, maybe there'll be some sort of inspirational leadership that will convince people that we have to do something. And in fact, you know, the economic problems right now may actually help in that it's desperate. There are a lot of people out of jobs. None of that is good. But it may be an opportunity to turn things around and try and do things a little bit differently. And if you're looking for new industries, like rather than, you know, keeping alive old industries that aren't really doing anything good, why not try and subsidize or stimulate some new industries like that are much more sustainable than anything we've had in the past? So there, you know, there's opportunities. But I mean, if people are going to object to driving less or the relatively small things, then I think we're in big trouble.
There's a house in this book, and where is this house?
The Net Zero House?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's in Edmonton. So, you know, everybody knows Edmonton's a pretty cold place, but this actually was built by a friend of mine, and it's built to absorb as much solar energy as possible, either by photovoltaic cells that will absorb solar energy, convert it to electricity, and power the appliances in the house, or including electric heaters, or circulating water that gets heated up by the sun and then is used to heat the house and to provide hot water for showers and washing dishes and so on. But over the course of a year, it waxes and wanes, right? In the summer, it gains lots of energy. In the winter, it has to expend energy because it's very cold. But over the course of the year, this house actually gives more energy back to the electric grid than it takes. So you actually make money heating and powering your house. Now, you know, it's more expensive than a typical house because it's better insulated. The windows are higher quality. The photovoltaic cells are relatively expensive still. But I think it's important as a proof of principle. You can actually have a house at 53 degrees north latitude, which is probably the most northerly net zero house in the world. There aren't many of them anyway. And you can do it. And they're building another one now, and they're probably going to keep building them. So I think it's an inspirational thing.
And your friend, he lives in it, does he?
He lives next door, actually. So he's going to... It's actually a duplex, a side-by-side duplex, so they're selling one, and then they're going to keep, he and his company are going to keep the other one for maybe 6 more months as a demonstration thing, but then eventually they'll sell it too. And, you know, they overdid it, actually. Like, he was telling me they spent about $10,000 just trying to get the last, like, 1% of solar electricity out of it, and realized later that... had they not done that, it would have only cost the homeowner about $120 a year. So, you know, there's no sense investing $10,000 to save $120. So in the next house, they're smarter now about this. So it'll be cheaper to build, cheaper to buy, and it will still be net zero.
In reading the book, what I was struck was how good it looked. And I guess that's the designers. Whose decision was it to... were you involved in the design of the book?
No, not at all. But I have been in... Oh, the book.
Yeah.
I was still thinking of the house.
Yeah.
It was really designed pretty much by Penguin, the publishers. I mean, I think it does look really good too, and I can say that because I didn't really have much to do with the design. But it, you know, that's the one of the appeals of it, I think, is that because it comes from a TV series, you've got a ton of visuals that you can use, and if you tell the story right and match the pictures to the story, then it becomes like TV. It has that vividness that you can't always capture if it's just print.
You travel the country. You give speeches and lectures throughout the nation. When you're asked to speak somewhere, invariably, I guess the goal is to make science understandable.
Yeah.
Do you find that there's a great, I don't know how to put this, like, is there a desire from your audience, or do you find that they're very keen on you, on whatever you're talking about, that they want to know more perhaps about science and how it relates to them?
I think so. I think that, you know, there's always been a bit of a problem that people somehow get turned off by the science they took in school because it was challenging and, you know, it seemed to be a bit boring and everything else. And so they acquire an attitude, and mostly that attitude is, well, I'm not cut out to be interested in science. But, you know, it's a lot easier for us in the entertainment world to present science because we don't have the job that a teacher has where you have to teach a curriculum and so on. So we can just pick the really interesting stories and make them interesting by the way we tell those stories. So as long as the story is entertaining, I think it can be a science story or any kind of story, and people will listen. So I really think our job, those of us who are interested in communicating science, our job is to, you know, tell stories in an interesting way. And at least when it comes to television, illustrate them in an interesting way. And, you know, you can't, like these days, given the number of channels available and visual stuff on the internet, in television, and the same applies to this book, you have to have really compelling pictures. If you try and get by with a couple of talking heads and a couple of slides, it's not going to work. And so there actually are lots of science stories that are quite difficult to tell because they deal with things that aren't easily visualized. So I think that's the key, though, that you tell a good story and you have, you know, the sounds and the visuals and everything else that a good story needs, then people will listen.
And on climate change, do you find that there's a great deal of awareness, and not just among people of your generation, but say my generation, young people?
I think young people are more aware of it. And I think the resistance, if my reading of the media is right, the resistance to the idea comes from, you know, I don't know how old people would be, but let's say, you know, sort of, and for some reason it tends to be mostly politically conservative people over the age of 50. And, you know, you could speculate for a long time as to why that is. I think young people, I think the beauty, the reason that young people are more on side, I think, is that, you know, let's take the example of, are you going to drive your car downtown or are you going to ride a bicycle? Well, you know, I do a lot of bike riding in Toronto, but let's face it, the vast majority of bike riders are people in their teens and 20s and maybe 30s. I mean, I know there's lots of it at every age, but that's the majority. So making changes, I mean, in a way it's like this, right? You know, you're in your 20s and you haven't really acquired a lot of material wealth. It's a lot easier to adjust to having less because you don't already have it. It's people who have, you know, a 4,000 square foot house that, you know, where some of the rooms they only visit on Fridays, it's a little bit difficult for them to imagine cutting down on the energy requirements of a house like that or even moving into a smaller one. Whereas if you haven't got a house yet, it's an easier idea to come to grips with.
How long have you hosted Daily Planet? It's nearly 14 years.
Oh, since the beginning. So, like, Daily Planet was, the first version of the show was something called At Discovery Canada, and that started in January of 1995. And then it's been a daily show from then till now. It started to become, it was renamed Daily Planet, I guess, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago. So I've been doing it the whole time.
And you're still enjoying doing it?
Did you say that with a certain amount of incredulity?
Well, no, I just...
You know what? What I like about, I mean, inevitably, like I did Quirks and Clarks on CBC Radio for a long time, and eventually I got tired of it. It's just, you don't have that many options as to how you do a story. So the stories are interesting, but then the way of doing them gets to be tedious. And, you know, there's a certain amount of that in doing Daily Planet, but the stories are still really interesting, and we're actually, I think, getting more and more popular. And the thing that I really like most is that there's a huge number of kids from, say, 10 years old to 18, something in that range, that watch the show. And I think that's the best because, you know, those are the people, those are the kids who will, you know, they don't have to remember all the facts of everything they've seen, but they do have an impression that science is cool and interesting. And I think that's really important because hopefully some of that will spin off and they'll, you know, be interested in science. They may become scientists. They'll be interested in reading about science, you know, even if they become lawyers or doctors, whatever. And so I think that's the, I think that's one of the most important things that Daily Planet is doing. It's turning, you know, relatively young kids on to science.
This is a cool book and a tremendous one. Congratulations on it and continued good luck with it, Jay.
Thanks a lot.
The book is called The Daily Planet Book of Cool Ideas, Global Warming and What People Are Doing About It. It's published by Penguin, $28. DiscoveryChannel.ca is the website. Jay Ingram on the line. I'm Joseph Planta.